We are going to look this morning at Galatians chapter 6 in some amount of depth. So if you have a Bible and would like to turn there with me, that's where we're going to spend most of this morning. Galatians chapter 6. I'd like to give just a little bit of background to the book of Galatians before we start. The book of Galatians is written somewhere around 49 AD before the general council in Jerusalem. And the Galatians are being bothered by Judaizers. Now, Judaizers are Jews that have converted to Christianity but still want new converts to follow the laws of Moses in order to be complete. And if you read in other books in the New Testament, what it tells us is that essentially the Jews wanted to be able to lord it over the Christians, that they had the old law first. Now, Paul, as a Jew who is now a Christian, is writing to the Christians at Galatia. Now, the little map didn't turn out as well, but that's Italy, there's Greece, and this small inset box is what you see up here. This is where Galatia is on this land bridge. And he is talking to Christians, about Christians, dealing with Christians in chapter 6. Go ahead and look at verse 1. Brothers and sisters, if someone is caught in a sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently. But watch yourselves, or you may also be tempted. Now, I appreciated Brother David's reading this morning. The NIV has a lot more issues with subject-pronoun agreement than the version that Brother David read this morning. But what does it mean if somebody is caught in a sin? There are at least two meanings for that phrase. One of them means that somebody has been found engaging in a sin, to catch someone. That would be like perhaps the woman caught in adultery, which we're going to look at in just a minute. But the other meaning of caught in a sin means someone who is engaged in a sin and cannot seem to turn loose from it. I want us to look just briefly at the story of the woman who was caught in adultery. Now, that's in the book of John, chapter 8, and it starts in verse 3. And it reads, "The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery. And having set her in the center of the court, they said to him, 'Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery, in the very act. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say?' They were saying this, testing him, so that they might have grounds for accusing him." Now before we go any further, the Pharisees and the scribes that brought this woman weren't really concerned with this woman at all. What they were worried about is Jesus and his popularity. And really, they thought they got him here, because the Romans had already taken the power of execution away from the Jews. The Jews had to bring prisoners that they thought were worthy of death to the Romans to be executed. So if Jesus said, "Go ahead and follow the law of Moses and stone this woman," then the Pharisees could turn Jesus over to the Romans for sedition. But if Jesus tells them, "No, don't stone her," now he's guilty of blasphemy, because now he's contradicting the law of Moses. So they thought they had him in a lose-lose situation. But Jesus stooped down, and with his finger he wrote on the ground. But when they persisted in asking him, he straightened up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her." And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones, and he was left alone. And the woman, where she was, in the center of the court. Straightening up, Jesus said to her, "Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you?" And she said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said, I do not condemn you either. Go, and from now on sin no more. Now, when we read that, you have to understand the tone with which you read that is complete conjecture. And interestingly enough, tone changes a lot of meaning. But you have to understand that this woman is not standing in isolation with Christ in some lonely place. Jesus was teaching when the scribes and the Pharisees showed up. There's a crowd. And when Jesus deals with this woman who is caught in a sin, he says, I don't condemn you either. Why? She was guilty. Everybody there knew she was guilty, including her. Go, and from now on, sin no more. Luckily, my son has left the audience. But, see, in my house, that would have been an excuse for a lecture at the very least. And my son has gotten to a point in his young life where he dreads dad's lectures. And so perhaps dad should lecture a little less. But it fascinates me that the only thing this woman gets is, go and sin no more. Let's go back to Galatians chapter 6, verse 1. And it says, when somebody is caught in a sin, you who live by the Spirit should restore that person gently. Well, let's begin with, what does the word restore mean? Well, by definition, re means to do something again. What is it that Jesus is doing for this woman again? He's trying to bring her into a right relationship with God, is he not? The woman is a Jew. She knows the law. She was reared on the law. But clearly she has strayed from that, and as a result her relationship with God has suffered. Jesus is trying to bring her back into communion with God. He says, don't just restore that person, but do it gently. You know what happens to most of us when we get attacked because we were sinning? We get defensive. Or we justify ourselves. Neither one of which is overly useful. When Jesus says, go and sin no more, if you read down the next couple of verses, he doesn't talk to her anymore. He turns back to the crowd he was already teaching and works with them. This woman gets to walk away in relative obscurity. I want to deal with just a minute for the other meaning of if someone is caught in a sin. Interestingly enough, most of us don't commit hundreds of different sins. Most of us commit the same sin over and over and over. You want to know what that looks like? Go read the Old Testament. The Old Testament tells you about the Israelites. They don't do hundreds of different sins. They do the same sin over and over and over and over. That's being caught in a sin, not being able to get free. Brothers and sisters, how do you know if somebody is caught in a sin? It has to do with relationships, does it not? You have to know your brothers and sisters well enough to know when their behavior has changed, when their demeanor has changed. And interestingly enough, in order to know a brother or a sister well enough to know a brother or sister is caught in sin, that requires one of our most precious commodities. That's right, it's time. Most of us don't feel like we have enough of it. Most of us feel like we're using it as fast as we can get it. But the way to develop relationships with our brothers and sisters is to spend time with them. That's how we know when our brothers and sisters are caught in a sin. Verse 2 says, go ahead and carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. Well, that first section, carry each other's burdens, is kind of an interesting statement. Carrying one another's burdens is another one of those reflections that requires time. The picture here is from an Army basic training manual. we're going to get to, see the bag under his arm there, right? The one that's holding the rifle. That's his, the man who's carrying the wounded fellow, that's his load. The rifle, that's his rifle. You'll notice that the wounded fellow doesn't have a bag on his back. That's because the dude carrying him doesn't need to carry that. He needs to carry the wounded fellow. By the way, if you're carrying a wounded fellow off the field, where's he going? He's going to get medevaced out, yes? But the one doing the carrying, where's he going? He's going back to the battle. He needs his load. In James chapter 2, verse 16, James says, if one of you says to someone in need, go in peace and keep warm and be fed, but does nothing about their needs, what good does that do? We need to know what the needs are in order to help brothers and sisters with the needs that they have. Now, verse 2 has a second part. It says, and in this way you fulfill the law of Christ. And my question is, well, how do I fulfill the law of Christ? What is the law of Christ? Well, Matthew chapter 13, verse 34 tells us, a new commandment I give to you. You are to love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. And by this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. Now it's true that Christ there is not talking to members of the church, because the church doesn't exist. But Christ is sitting in a circle of disciples talking to disciples about disciples. It's going to be the same group of folks. Guess how you prove that you love somebody? You spend time with them. If anyone thinks that they are something when they are not, they are deceiving themselves. Now, you'll forgive me for this next slide, but that was the person who popped to my mind. Now, for those of you who are not familiar, that is Frank Burns, of a TV show that's long since dead. But he thought himself a superior officer, and everybody knew that he was not. But again, what he is referencing in this verse, where he says, if anybody thinks they're something when they are not, what is that? Is that not arrogance? Is that not pride? You need to be able to assess yourself before you start going to talk to brothers and sisters. The next verse says, each one should test their own actions, and then they can take pride in themselves alone without comparing themselves to someone else, for each one should carry their own load. Now, interestingly enough, verse 4 seems to contradict verse 2. Because verse 2 says you should carry one another's burdens, but verse 4 says you should be able to carry your own load. Well, I would submit to you that verse 4 is still talking about the one who felt the need to do the correcting. In this picture you see here, those gentlemen are all in full battle gear. They need to be able to carry all that stuff all by themselves all the time. Now, if you are too tired to carry your own load, how are you going to pick a brother up? Now, in Matthew chapter 7, verse 4, it says, how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, while there is still a beam in your own eye, you hypocrite? First take the beam out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Brothers and sisters, I submit to you that this is not talking about perfection. If we had to wait to be perfect to help one another, we would never do it. He's not talking about perfection here. He is talking about being good enough to carry your own load and help somebody else too. But the first thing you need to be able to do is carry your own load. And if you can't do that, you should probably not be the one doing the correcting. Nevertheless, the one who receives instruction in the word should share all good things with their instructor. Now, I have seen that verse taken out of context a number of times, and people talk about paying preachers. And you know what? This particular passage has nothing to do with paying preachers. The one who receives instruction, that is to say, the one who is being corrected, should share good things with their instructor, all good things with their instructor. You know what? Even the strong get tired of needing to be the strong. Did you have a good day? Go tell that to the person who's been helping you. You shouldn't always be full of negative news when you call a brother or sister. Share the good things too. Share your victories. You know what? Even if they're small victories, share those things as well. Because the strong need to be encouraged too. Starting in verse 7, it says, "Do not be deceived, for God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Whoever sows to please the flesh from the flesh will reap destruction. And whoever sows to please the Spirit from the Spirit will reap eternal life." You've heard that you can fool some of the people some of the time, and you can fool all of the people some of the time. But you know what? You're not fooling God. Because God is looking at your heart. There's an interesting example of this in Acts chapter 5. The church is young. The church is new. There's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of energy going on. People are selling property. They're selling houses. And they're sharing. They're trying to share their burden, share the load. And a husband and wife team who has some extra property decide, hey, let's sell that and give it the proceeds to the apostles. But let's not give them all the proceeds. But let's just tell them we'll give them all the proceeds. That way, everybody pat us on the back too. We'll start reading in verse 3 of Acts chapter 5. It says, "And then Peter said, Ananias, how is it that Satan has filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and withhold some of the proceeds from the land? Did it not belong to you before it was sold? And after it was sold, was it not at your disposal? How could you conceive such a deed in your heart? For you have not lied to men, but to God. And on hearing these words, Ananias fell down and died. And great fear came over all who heard what had happened." Now, I chose this particular piece of art over a lot of other pieces of art. Because, interestingly enough, apparently in the early 1200s, 1300s, they were under the impression that this particular story taught that if you don't tithe, you're going to die. And you know what? This story is not about tithing. Peter's pretty clear here. Dude, the land is yours. Nobody asked you for it. And even once you sold the land, the money was yours. Nobody asked you for a dime. The problem is that Ananias came, set in his heart to lie. And Peter said, "You didn't come to lie to me. You came to lie to God." And Ananias died for it. And you know what? The men who carried Ananias off were just coming back when Sapphira showed up to tell the same story. And she died too. Not because she wanted to keep some of the money. It was her money. Because she thought she was mocking God, and God's not going to have it. God is going to judge our hearts. Verse 9. "Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up." Remember that picture of those guys with pats on their backs? They're heavy. Last time I checked, they were ballpark 80 pounds, yes? Okay. 80 pounds. That's a pretty heavy load to be hauling around all day. I have heard this particular verse used out of context too, particularly by those who subscribe to the gospel of wealth theory, where if you will mind God, you will be blessed and be rich. And again, I don't think that's what this verse is saying. For at the proper time, we will reap a harvest if we do not give up. Well, every time in the New Testament that we're talking about harvesting, in a spiritual sense, this is Christ's return. And verse 10. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people. Let us do good to all people. Holy cow, when am I supposed to work? It's not what it says. As you have the opportunity, let us do good to all people, but especially to those who belong to the family of believers. Charity starts at home, and then it works outwards. Nobody says your family ought to suffer so you can help somebody else. But when you have all that you need, and some of what you want, then you can start looking out and start helping other people that don't have all they need. It's not hard to find those people. That family of believers, that's us. This morning, if you would like an opportunity to become a part of a family of believers, or if you'd like to learn more about this family of believers, our elders are here, and you can come forward as we stand and as we sing.